We do make a lot of Latigo, and when you whittle it, it just does nice long like spindles come off of it, essentially. They say it's supposed to cut like cheese.
I can't wait to make somebody whittle some Latigo for me.
Yeah, be like, get out a knife and give me a nice long strip.
Yeah, it's like, that's not cheese-ish at all. ShoeCast! Welcome to the Stitch Down ShoeCast, where we talk quality footwear, how it's made, and all the things we love about it. I'm Ben from StitchDown.com, and today I'm quite excited indeed to chat with two, count them two, Fritz Seidels, Fritz Jr. and Fritz Sr., who every day are continuing the tradition of the four-generation, 79-year-old Seidel Tanning Corp. in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We're going to get into Seidel's history and fluid approach to tanning and meeting shifting market demands, what in the hell all the machinery in a tannery is doing all day long, why making heavyweight boot leathers is so damn tough, and of course, cows getting diaper rash. But first, huge thanks to our sponsor this week, Nix Boots, who just happens to use many wonderful Seidel leathers and their exceptionally indestructible footwear. Check out what they've got at nixboots.com. Also, if you're the kind of person whose friends look at you weird when you keep talking about SPI count and the importance of proper quarter-facing gaps at parties, something tells me you'd fit in quite well in the Stitchdown Premium Discord, the finest place on the internet for the shoe and boot afflicted to all be afflicted together. We've got over 1,500 people chatting day and night about established and emerging makers, leathers, last, sizing, figuring out meetups, buying and selling with no fees in our marketplace, the whole thing. I honestly think you'd love it. More information on SDP in the Discord at stitchdown.com. And don't forget to save the date for Stitchdown's Bootcamp 2, a celebration of shoemaking in the community that loves it, this October 12th and 13th, 2024, in Industry City, Brooklyn. First bootcamp was very good. You can rest assured the second will be very gooder. We'll be announcing the opening lineup and have tickets available this May on StitchdownBootcamp.com. Can't wait to see you there. All right, Fritz Seidel and Fritz Seidel Jr. of Seidel Tanning in Milwaukee, welcome to the ShoeCast. What are you guys wearing on your feet today?
I've got a pair of Thorogoods on with Trail Crazy Horse.
My first great pair of boots.
Mm.
That exact thing.
I'm on the run today, so I'm in a pair of Nitro Pumas.
They sound fast.
Well, you got to be fast around here to keep up with a customer base.
So I think this is a good one to get out of the way up top. Seidel is, at this point, technically a retanner. Can you guys explain what that means and how that might be different from what other tanneries are doing?
Most tanneries are sort of down that road these days. Back in the 90s, when the water regulations changed, it became infinitely more difficult to do our own tanning in the size that we were. Many of the large beef packers actually are tanning in really large volume blue, taking their raw hides to blue. We decided really back in the early 90s to sort of make that move and start going that direction, bringing in blue from outside. What do you get there? You get hides that are not salted, so they're fresh off the animal and taken right into the tanning process. The hope is to get really a cleaner hide, clearer blue, less enamel issues with it. It's worked well for us really for many years. I would say for us, being a retanner, we bring the blue in, sort it. We're looking at selection. We're looking at the size of the skin or the side. We're looking at the thickness. We're sorting it for the amount of brands, no brands, trying to place it correctly into the products that we need to make, which is a full variety of from belt leather, heavyweight, all the way to linings or glove leather, which is really sort of the lower end of the leather spectrum.
In terms of thickness.
Well, in terms of thickness and then the grain quality.
Something to go off of real quick, just so if people don't know, you know, the difference between tanning and retanning. Rawhide tanning and wet blue tanning is the base tannage. And then what we do is we bring it in. And retanning is where you're imparting color. You're putting emulsified oils and waxes into the leather, vegetable extracts to, you know, give it that final feel. While we don't do the blue tanning, we work really closely with our blue hide tanners, one of them being DR Dietrich down here in Milwaukee. It's a 10-minute drive for us to go, you know, see where our wet blue is being made. We have a lot of input. There's a lot of feedback between, you know, us and Dietrich on what are we struggling with, you know, do we need to change anything in our tannage? So while we don't do it here, it's not like it's being done in God knows where. It's, you know, it's right down the street still. So we still have a pretty firm grasp on our bluing.
What Junior's saying is that we run with our formula. We're able to adjust it depending on the time of year and the needs of the skins or the hides are coming in. Sometimes they've got a little more hair, which means they've got to have a little more hair burn, longer hair burn to it. Maybe you want to get a little more chrome into the leather for certain purposes. So we are able to adjust it if we certainly need to, but we try to keep on a fairly consistent formula between the suppliers that we use. So we don't have a lot of variation. And that's certainly the trick or the end game is being able to reproduce the product day in and day out, every month for years on with the formulas that we've got.
Got it. So I imagine this plays into this, but Phil Callis from Ashland Leather and worked at Horween growing up has a lovely podcast with Nick. Everybody check it out. Full Grain Podcast. When we had him on, he has a firm belief that sorting, which you mentioned, is the most important step of them all in the tanning process. Agree, disagree, otherwise?
Well, sorting of the products you buy, definitely. There used to be the old adage was when you sold leather, this goes back 30, 40 years ago, it was a TR run. TR run stood for tannery run, straight run. Back in those days, the leathers were very basic. Nowadays, you're really making such a specific, defined product, whether it's for belt leather or equestrian or patch leather or linings or boot logger leather. These are all leathers that have become so specialized in the product they are that when the user making the product tends to switch back and forth between tanneries or locations, i.e. out of Mexico versus the U.S., there's notable differences. The shoe is going to take different shape. There's going to be more stretch, less stretch, just the stuffing in the leather, the nourishment to it. I mean, these are all aspects that a final user becomes really aware of once they are on your product and then switch into another product. And I'm not saying that switching to another product is going to be worse, but ultimately it's going to be different in some form because these are formulas that are well-developed and for the need of what the leather is going into.
I think at least on the sorting side, you kind of have to look at what you're making. I mean, there are a bunch of different types of tannages, and every tannery is going to be grading on some form of 1, 2, 3, 4s. You know, for us, we have, I think, 12 different sorts. It's kind of like, you know, 1 ABC, 2 ABC, 3 ABC, 4 ABC. And we do that because each one of those grades and the subgrades within them are product specific. I think grading is a really important part, but it ultimately kind of comes down into, okay, how do you fit that into, you know, the products that you're making? And so for us, you know, when we're trying to train our own sorters, a lot of the times it's long-term employees who know, you know, the types of leathers that we make. And then they look at, okay, what are the grades and what are the products that we're trying to make out of those grades? Because you're not going to take like a number one sort and throw it into something that's like Crazy Horse. It doesn't make sense. Crazy Horse is a great leather, but you're buffing the surface there and you would never do that with a number one. While grading is important, I think it's really, you have to have a grasp on what are you making and divvy it out that way. Because the last thing you want is, you know, aniline full grain tannage and then it gets to final sort and it's got a bunch of pits and scratches in it. That's where sorting is really crucial.
Obviously, you guys make all sorts of leather for all sorts of needs and uses, but we do tend to talk a little bit about footwear leather on this podcast. As I understand, that wasn't always what you were making. And I'm really curious about just kind of how that came to be, what propelled you into that to, you know, really one of the certainly North American tanneries, American tanneries that is right in the mix with great footwear. Like it's hand in hand with Seidel. Like, how did that all start, basically?
Well, Ben, I appreciate that thought that we're in that category. there's no doubt that it was certainly not where I started in my career. And this goes back two generations. And I'll just try and give you a quick synopsis here. Is my grandfather, Erwin A. Seidel, had worked for Trostel and was laid off. He bought into a tannery, which there was a Thiele that decided he was sort of aging out. My grandfather bought into it. And so it was known as Thiele Seidel back in the late 40s, early 50s. At that point, they were basically a contract tanner. Contract tanning was a lot like what's happened mostly in the third world countries, where you see a lot of glove leather or lining leather or just basic leathers being made. Anyways, step up from there, my father got into the business and there was some diversification. Back then, there was a lot of garment leather and a lot of lightweight leather still being produced. Garment was flight jackets and motorcycle jackets and athletic jackets and linings for cowboy boots. I mean, we used to do like a million feet a month for cowboy boots and lining. And that was our sort of niche. You know, I think what transpires with a lot of businesses is that certain people are acquainted with certain people, or certain people that come into work with the facility have different perceptions of the types of leathers you should make. Well, it just so happened we ended up with a Turkish tanner, which is when I first got into the business. And he was a real interesting guy. Little wild, little bit of a designer type. I was sort of making wacky colors and thinking about different ways to make leather. So early in my career, I was exposed to a widening variety of leathers, i.e. colors, bag leathers, belt leathers, wallet leathers. That was probably in the 80s we were doing that. And then there was another transition that took place, the transition of offshoring, which I'm sure you guys are familiar with. And that's when the U.S. leather business started to shrink notably. And as that happened, the large tanneries like Pfister and Vogel, the Gebhardt tannery, Cudahy was in there. I mean, these are all tanneries that are now gone, but we're making the heavier weight leathers. As those leathers or as those tanneries sort of met their demise because they couldn't sell the volume that they had and they were large, you know, they started to close up doors or consolidate. So I was able to really start buying machinery at major discount prices. That machinery allowed us to sort of transition to where we are today, making a lot of these heavyweight leathers. And I'll just say, Ben, the market has changed significantly. A lot of the business, leather business that was being done back in the 80s and 90s and really early 2000s is marginally there today. But what is here in the United States is a lot of heavyweight leather, a lot of belt leather, equestrian, some case goods. It's a much different market, but I think where we've gone with this is markets open up to us because of the need for leather. You sort of adapt. I always knew how to make lightweight leathers. With the people that we brought into the facility with these other tanneries going out of business, it helped us to adapt into heavier weight leathers. And heavier weight leathers are a much more difficult product to make.
Why is that?
Well, you got to have the right machinery that's strong enough to really get this stuff flat. Heavyweight hides really want to have a lot of draw on them. They're hard to tan. They're hard to re-tan. They're hard to penetrate. Everything takes double the time that it does on a lightweight. Lightweights are easy. Running really an upholstery factory is about as easy as it gets because the product is so uniform. For us, at any given time, we're running 40 different leathers through the tannery, and every one of them's got their own direction they got to go and be handled in their own manner. A lot of it's similar, but yet you got to have skilled people that know how to manipulate it to where it has to get to.
Definitely.
Where did we start? Where you were asking how we got to where we are today?
How'd you got into like making just fantastic boot leather when that wasn't always a core competency? Maybe
on the boot leather, it's, you know, there's a little bit of craziness that goes along with the chemistry. I'll just say this. You have to be reasonably open-minded to a little bit of change, not a lot, be able to follow your hand and to be able to create new product. It's try new things. And along with this, Ben, the leather industry the manufacturers that are left. I mean, we've gone through an amazing transformation. When you look at the environmental and chemical side of the leather business, I've lived it. We both lived it. There's an amazing amount of sort of R&D and watching the kettle come to a boil to get yourself into these new areas and being able to make the chemicals work the way they used to. It's gotten infinitely harder and more expensive. A lot of tanneries have those challenges. It's not for the faint of heart, I'll put it that way. And you can't find it in a book. It's more trial and error. You know, it's been an interesting last really 10 to 15 years, I would say.
I guess the one thing I would say about where we've been successful with a lot of the footwear is the American footwear or the American tanneries in general, I would say, run a lot more traditional leathers. So while, yes, there's been a lot of progression in, you know, the chemicals used and new ways to retan, I would say why we're successful is a lot of the tannages that we're running are a little more old school. I think the U.S. tanneries in general favor a lot more fuller tannages, you know, higher veg contents than other parts of the world. And I think it lends itself to a better product, especially for something like where, you know, we're making a lot of logger boot leathers. You can't make empty retans work with that. You know, I think the other part of it that makes us successful is we run a lot of aniline leathers. We're not really painting. Operationally, we go through like the painstaking, you know, polishing and plating and polishing again. And that's where I think it makes a product that separates itself a little bit more from easy leathers to make, I guess, or, you know, more uniform over finished leathers.
Right. Like the stuff I'm making in my bathroom.
Yeah.
It's coming out great now. We're really working it.
Here was a great example. I mean, you go back 2 years ago with like Thorogood and they changed their management thought. Well, we can do it a little cheaper. We can bring it out of the DR and make more money on the boot. Well, they went down that road for about a year. And this is when we had been making a product, the old moccasin product for their mock toe boot. And sales were always good with it. I mean, just consistent and good. And that thing just fell off the deep end for those guys. It was really the feel, the look, the wearability of the leather at the end of the day. Well, we got it back on track and they're back to where they were. You know, that to me, it was so eye-opening as to how leather makes part of that product so valuable. They saw it in sales.
It's kind of funny whenever, you know, we'll always try to steer customers into what we think the best leather is, but sometimes you just can't do it. And you'll hear production complain about it. They'll be like, oh, we're X leather, we're over finishing, and, you know, we shouldn't be making it like this. And a lot of the times it is, you know, it comes down to what the customer wants, but sometimes you got to kind of educate the customer and be like, maybe you're going to lose a little bit of cutability, or maybe you might see, you know, a handful of more defects, but there's more to the leather than just laying it out on a table and cutting it. It's how it ages it, how it feels it, how it molds in a last. There are all these properties that you can have in leather and you can't always get them when you paint finish over the top. And I think that's why we tend to not paint finish over the top on a lot of these leathers.
Junior, you mentioned, you know, the difference between paint finish leather and aniline leather. For anybody listening who doesn't know, could you just sum that up real quick?
What we consider aniline is there's no pigment. Basically, we might put a clear coat over the top, but it's the natural grain that's really coming through. You're not trying to cover over. You're trying to enhance what the natural look of the leather is. We could put oil wax on top, or it could just be crust, versus semi-aniline would be 5%. Pigment or something, just to, you know, you're still going to see the grain character, but you're getting a little more coverage. And then you can go all the way. There's a lot of steps on how much you want to finish. But basically, if you're going pigment, you're really not seeing the natural grain of the leather. You know, you look at something like a PU coated or a patent leather, that's kind of the final stage of finishing. You know, you're not going to get more finished than patent leather.
And just quick aside, the short history that Senior gave is fantastic and I think tells the broad story very well. I would highly recommend that anybody listening who wants the extremely deep look at the Seidel history to give Josh's interview with you two and Charlie Holbrook on stitchdown.com, because I mean, I read it like 3 or 4 times
I mean, I've read it dozens of times, but three or four in the last week, just kind of prepping for this. And man, it's wonderful. It really tells the whole tale. One of the parts from that that I pulled out that I think really tells the story of, you know, keeping your customers happy because they want their customers to be happy in footwear and how tricky that can be. We have a little story from Charlie here. He was saying, you know, you guys start making heavier weight leather, right? And shipping it out. This is a quote from Charlie. Leather stiff as a board. And they told me they wanted it firmer, even firmer. But then they wanted us to go in the other direction as people started complaining about carpal tunnel syndrome. Their throughput slowed down because the leather is hard to work with. But then they go, oh, well, if we had softer leather, then we don't have these carpal tunnel issues and we get like five or six more pairs of boots per day out of our guys. So then it was softer. Now it's shifted back, firmer, and it keeps going back and forth and back and forth. Is that tough to deal with or how do you contend?
That one, it kind of goes in waves. So this is mostly for, you know, the logger boot guys who are hand lasting. You know, if one of them starts trending firmer, you kind of know that everybody's going to start trending firmer. But ultimately, it just comes down to, you know, the company. Some people like it heavier, some people like it firmer, some people like it softer. You know, those logger oil tan products, I think it just comes down to ultimately the people working on them. But traditionally, you know, they've always been an extremely firm product. And a lot of that is because they want tight break. It's a really thick piece of leather. So they want, you know, stiff ankle support. You know, we complain like, oh, like they're going softer. Really, they want to go like, we have these things called temper meters and they want to go like 5 points softer, which is really like nothing. But it's just, you know, moving the needle that last little bit.
But they can tell.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if they have temper meters, but the guys who are working with the leather, a lot of those sorters and cutters, I mean, they've been working with it for forever and they just know the feel of the product.
Kind of as a follow-up to that, what makes a great lastable leather? And I know that can be different and we're, you know, talking about people doing it by hand versus machine, so maybe it's a complicated answer, but like what goes into it? What kind of ingredients are you putting into it? Maybe it's a sorting thing. Like how do you make a leather that just lasts really well in bootmaking?
Yeah, that's a tricky question.
That's why I asked it.
I got to give you a broad answer on this. And so it goes all the way from, you know, in the old days, the inherent way to last out these heavyweight logger leathers was to soak it for an hour. That becomes very limp at that point and makes it a lot easier to last. But back in those days, these were shops. When I first started, I mean, I'd go into some of these shops like a White's or a Knicks or a Koolian boot. You know, if they were putting out 10 pair of boots a day, that was about it. That whole Northwestern business has really expanded and these guys do pump out a fair amount of boots. So now they've gone from probably a mulling process where they're misting or doing a slight dip, let the parts mull for a period of time and then go into lasting. And probably three out of the five that we sell, I would imagine they're doing automatic lasting these days. Now they've got their way of producing, stretching, getting it down in the last a lot quicker. You know, whatever their method is going to be, and it's got to be like everything. It's get production out. Everybody's got their own flavor for what they want and how they're going to get it through their production. We try to produce it for everybody's liking, and they're all a little different.
So to create that, obviously, there's a tanning process behind it and, you know, sorting and all that. What makes a great tanner, as in like the chemist behind it all, like the person, like what do they need to know? What kind of backgrounds do they have? Like, I mean, it's a dark art and a science, and what do they need to be great?
For us, it's certainly somebody that is not willing to change too much, but certainly be aware of what the properties need to be for the leather. And then knowing the chemical or the retanning agents and or the fat lickers that are out there and available, which are constantly changing, you know, how to bring all those together to give you the same product again and again and again. You know, those are the challenges of a tannery. Is I think where a lot of tanneries over the years have fallen apart is when you transition to a new tanner, maybe you get somebody that's making too many changes. And then it's sort of the leather morphs into a different product and becomes problematic to for the end user. So I would just say, ultimately, it's like the guy you want mixing, and this is the drum operators to the tanner and the guys that are doing the drying systems. I mean, it's all got to have a synergy that works together. Just because you can make the leather and the drum doesn't mean you're drying it correctly. There's just a lot to it, Ben, at the end of the day. The tanner certainly has a lot to do with it. You try not to change too much. The middle of the tannery is an important place because all that leather is going there and constantly flowing through. So you got to have somebody there that can monitor if there's a notable change for the worse, and then try and get back to correcting it if there is. And then obviously you got to be able to get the penetration of oils and waxes and finishes on it correctly. It's a juggle.
I believe it. Sounds like you need a break. So let's take a quick break and we'll be right back with the Fritzes on the ShoeCast.
Nick's Boots' 60th anniversary this year. 60 years! So first, let's just take a second to revel in 6 decades of the Spokane brand making some of the best, most deliciously indestructible boots in the entire world. Hey, nice job. Great revel. So what's up for 60? Well, for starters, new leathers, including Horween's wildly water-resistant yet absolutely beautiful Shackleton tannage, which you can apply to more boot-style options, sizes, and widths than literally anyone on the market. Also, new boot models. Some built fresh from the ground up. I can't really reveal just now, but trust me, you'll love them. And one employee-designed boot each month of Nick's Big 6-0. New wedge soles to accommodate larger and wider sizing. Yes, wedge soles rule. I personally insisted on this development being in here. Maybe a collaboration with us over here at Stitchdown? Finally! We're working on it, all right? We're working on it. And of course, everything is built with a time-honored construction coupled with some of the best customer service in the whole game. Point is, I'd strongly recommend paying attention to everything Nick's is going to throw at 60. Check out their YouTube channel and sign up for their newsletter at nicksboots.com. And now, back to the ShoeCast.
All right, we're back with Fritz and Fritz Seidel on the ShoeCast. So there is an endless amount of machinery and equipment in the tannery, as you've mentioned. Number one, I have to say you've done a fabulous job on your Instagram of showcasing a ton of it and explaining a little bit. It's probably one of the best looks that you can get at a working tannery, you know, kind of every day for the most part. So everybody should check that out. Most of this equipment I had no idea about, to be honest. And I've been in tanneries, I've seen it, and it can be a little overwhelming as somebody who, you know, doesn't do it every day. So I thought that we could roll through some of the machines that you guys have, and you could enlighten me and everyone else as to what they do. This is in no order whatsoever, but these are some that I found pretty darn interesting, and people can actually go and check out on the Instagram if they just kind of scroll around a little bit with videos and all that. All right, the first one, great name, the roll coaster. What's the roll coaster do?
The roll coaster, is it like roll press? I don't know. Maybe I labeled something wrong.
It was autocorrect.
Roll coder is probably what you're
roll
going
coder. On. I'll send you these to edit later.
That's up and finishing. Basically, there's a couple different ways to lay finish or oil and wax on the surface of leathers. So we have two different types of roll coders. We have specific ones for oil wax, and then we have specific ones for urethane finishes or stains, one that has to stay cleaner. But essentially what they are heated rolls that, you know, have a little bit of what I would call like teeth in them. So essentially, you know, you have different rolls for different amounts you want to put on the surface of leather. And essentially it's just a feed through so that you apply finish or oil and wax evenly. So you can really measure down to the gram per square foot. So if you're on our Instagram and you see some leather going in one side, that's one color, and going out the other side, that's another color. It's probably the roll coder.
These roller coders are really technology that was brought into the leather business probably back in the late 90s, early 2000s. This is when you really started to see them. Most of the producers are Italy or Germany. It's like gravure printing, but what we're doing is we're applying more oil and wax or finish on it, and it's direct application. Why is that so good today? Because a lot of these oils and waxes, for instance, used to be done in the drum, and which we still do, but you don't have to do it to the same extent. in the drum. And you can get better take up in the drum by applying the max that the leather will take and not overdoing it and putting it down the sewer and into the effluent. And if you need a little more juice in the leather, you can do it upstairs. So environmentally, these things brought us really into the 21st century. And the same thing with finish. Instead of spraying finish on, which the application there is about 60% hits the leather, 40% goes up the stack, you can go a direct application with finish and get literally 95% on the leather, if not higher. There's always a little dribble off the perimeter of the leather, but really the application is much better and it's more efficient. It's cost effective. It doesn't pay to put any of these chemicals down the sewer or up the stack. I mean, it's all you're doing is not applying. So these roller coaters have really helped in leather manufacturing, and most tanners use them these days.
There's our roller coater. I really enjoyed watching the staking machine operate. What can you tell me about the staking machine?
Well, staking machines have come a long way also. In the old days, there was something called the Melissa, really a side leather machine that was only about 1,600 millimeters wide, and that would go butt to neck. Nowadays, we stake leather from backbone to belly, and that's the natural stretch and softening way to get leather soft. The staker is to soften leather. You can set the settings on these machines from very light to very hard. It's virtually fingers that are pounding into a hole as the leather is brought through the machine. It's used in multiple places in the tannery for us.
How about a drying tunnel?
That's a pretty basic device. Leather comes out of the drum. It's very wet, 100% moisture in the by weight. We're working the leather to get that moisture out. And the toughest part is right out of the drum. The last area that we need to get that last bound moisture from virtually 20% and down is always very hard to get that moisture out. So either you can use a drying tunnel, which is a heated tunnel with the sticks going through it or hanging device, or you can go into a hang dry area. Typically, in a tunnel, we'll do it quicker. Force dries it, does make the leather a little more bony. But if you go to hang dry, it's a little more subtle drying. And typically the leather, it's a little kinder to the leather. The way I would call this, Ben, is like, it's the difference between using like a microwave or a burner on a stove versus an oven. These are all different ways of cooking.
Okay, yeah. And it seems like different types of leather require different drying processes, different machinery, correct?
You got it.
Is there anything that stands out that requires, you know, a specific extra touch in terms of leather type or tannage or whatever it might be?
Well, so we say four different types of drying that we do here in our facility. You know, the drying tunnel, that is what we call stick drying, essentially. That's the last little bit. Prior to that, you know, we're going through, and depending on the tannage, we have vacuum drying, toggle drying, and pasting. And when I say depending on the tannage, certain tannages we can only dry certain ways. Heavier oil and wax leathers like our Crazy Horses, you know, we're going to go and paste those because if we were to vacuum dry them, it would clog up the screens on the vacuum dryer versus slightly drier tannages, maybe something that's more oil heavy, not really waxy, we'll go to the vacuum dryer. Or if we're doing waterproofs, we'll go to the vacuum dryer. And then for toggle drying, we look at softer, glovier leathers. A lot of our bison and pebbled or milled leathers will go on the toggle dryer. And that's because I don't actually know how to describe the drying on that. It's a little more airy, I would say, and open. You get a little more stretch out of the leather there. So it's really dependent on the tannage. You know, we're set up in a way that we try to run a lot of different leathers that they get divvied off at drying so that we don't overload one drying system. And also we have the ability to make multiple different types of leathers.
A great example would be the leathers that go to toggling are typically very open fiber structure, milled types of leathers, upholstery. A lot of our bison will go there because bison tends to not produce what we call an ultra tight piece of leather. It's better for leather goods and sort of soft milled, enhance the bison grain. So that goes to toggle. versus like the oil tans. Those are all vacked because they got to be ultra tight. Hopefully that gives you a little bit of a flavor for variation of drying.
Definitely. And then one more from me, not part of the tanning process, but I deeply enjoyed watching the waterproof testing. This is a great one. It's like a little claw that has a, you know, a hinge on it, and it's just shifting this leather up and down, up and down, up to 2,500 times. There's a little counter ticking all the way, like your odometer there. How's this work, and what goes into making, you know, a leather that you would consider to be waterproof?
Well, that's all got to be basically done in the drum, and that's chemically treated these days with waterproof fat liquors. We went through some transition here. That whole waterproofing agent and fat liquor system has really changed 180 in the last few years because of the PFAPs. The treatment is done in the wet end. From there, it's got to be dried correctly. There again, you've got to vacuum dry this stuff to compact it down and fill the sites and lock them with the waterproofing fat liquor in it. And then from there, it's got to be dried correctly and fully dried. You cannot leave any moisture in it. The machine you were talking about previously is our Maser tester. As we bring the material through, we'll check it in the crust and in the finish. In the crust, it has to run typically 15,000, we call it, flexes. And then once you put the finish on it, you got to check it again. So there's some physical properties that really have to be tested, and most of those leathers go to people that where they're making boots or products that they're going to test it. So we try to send a certificate along with it.
I love that.
But so basically that test is, you know, you're taking a cutting from your dried hide, you lock it in, and you run it for however long it takes to really get to that 15 or 20 or 25,000 flexes. And then you take it out and you check, did you have a failure where it beat it up and it leaked? Or if it passed visually, you'll check the water absorption, essentially. That's a parameter of the test. There are a lot of leather-specific tests that were developed by a company called Satra. Basically, that's a uniformly recognized testing method for testing waterproofs. You know, I've seen some other ways that people test waterproofs, and it's not always really the most accurate. This in the leather industry is basically the agreed upon way to test waterproof.
All right. So probably because of my questioning, Fritz Sr. had to just leave. He left the room. We've still got Junior here though. So we'll close out with you. All right. So what did I miss? What was like the most important piece of machinery that I didn't, you know, see on Instagram on a video and therefore wrote it down on a page and asked you in no particular order whatsoever?
For the most part, you seem to have them covered, like spray booths, I guess. The one thing is with a lot of the machinery, it's you might use it in different ways. Something you look at like the hydraulic presses or like the plating machines that we have. We do a lot of ironing there, but they can also be used to put embossed prints into the leather or something like a roller press, where, you know, you can use it as a straight iron or you can print in like a hair cell look. You might use these in different stages of the process. So you might do it before finishing or after finishing. A lot of the machines in the tannery are just super versatile and they just get used in a million different ways, essentially.
The nice thing about tanning is how straightforward it is, I feel.
Yeah, it's straightforward 100% of the time and every piece comes out exactly the same. It's great.
It's going to be nice. I also thought it would be fun to just do something similar, but roll through some of your leathers, some that are more widely known and used and others that probably or definitely aren't. And we could just talk them through a little bit, describe, you know, maybe how they're tan properties, et cetera. What do you think?
Yeah, for sure.
All right, let's do it. So we didn't cover this one at the top, but Fritz Seidel Jr. You are familiar that everybody calls the leather and the brand and the tannery, Seidel.
We kind of joke about it here because everybody that works here also calls it Seidel. We kind of look at it like, oh, we're the Seidel family, but the tannery is Seidel. But, you know, I call it Seidel just because I've grown up with it. But I think for the most part, the vast majority of people call it Seidel.
It seems to be, you know, just kind of an American tradition because I think Skip would pronounce his last name Horween, right? So
Horween versus Horween.
Horween.
Okay. Gotcha. It's like, where's that syllable break?
Yeah, exactly. A little bit of emphasis. Anyway, you know, in good company, obviously. Point being here, there's another mispronunciation, perhaps, of a leather that Wesco has used for a long time and certainly others. They call domain and sometimes even maybe spell slightly differently, but I believe is Domani.
Nope, it's Domani.
Domani.
So, yeah, that's always been one that nobody has ever been able to really figure out. The story actually behind that, why that leather is named that, is so Charlie, our sales guy, he, you know, helped develop that leather. And when it came down to naming it, Charlie's a very avid biker and he actually won multiple national championships for his age group, but he always rides a Trek. And so we have Trek in our backyard. Like, we're family friends with the founders, and they have a line of bikes called Domani, Madone, and Amanda. And so when Charlie decided to name that leather, he named it after the Trek bikes. And then Madone was the dyed through version of that, which is named after the other Trek bike, the Madone.
Wait, and they have one called Amanda, but is it spelled like Amanda?
It's Amanda, E-M-O-N-D-A. Yeah, so no, but close.
Somebody's got this all figured out somewhere. What is it? How would you describe it? What do you like about it, especially for boots?
It's a really nice hand feel. Like, the tannage is actually a very oily tannage. Usually that product works best in footwear and leather goods. It was probably like our most refined pull-up leather for a while. Well, at least when I first started. Yeah, it's a pretty standard pull-up leather. Nice, suede-y flesh side. Domani is a natural back and a finished surface. They're using aniline dyes to get that nice level top coat. And it actually comes out super level for no pigment in there. It's just a really nice round tannage, tight break, you know, really vibrant pull up. I feel like we don't really see it come through enough anymore, but it was a really nice leather 2 to 5 years ago.
Maybe it's kind of related to this next one that I want to talk about, you know, that kind of drop in the production of it, but the double shot that you've been making is fantastic stuff. I have some samples in it right now from Russell, you know, like another really nice pull-up leather, right?
So that one was really kind of developed in the like depths of COVID. You know, there were a couple months where it was extremely slow. You know, we were just ran a lot of samples and we were playing around with stuff. And so that was initially, you know, it was actually the Domani tannage. It's the same finishing system. So aniline dyes. We just played around with the retan. You know, I think we were pretty lucky when we were developing that. Truman actually kind of tested it out for us and gave us a lot of feedback. So we went through a couple iterations, but it was kind of the progression off of the Domani and Madone tannage. So we really changed up the retan, the stuffing, oils and waxes, and then we changed up our drying methods and some of the polishing. You know, it's a really nice product. It's different from Domani. It's a little more gutsy, I would say, a little more rugged, but it makes really nice footwear. I mean, I have a couple pairs of footwear out of Double Shot, and not only are they, you know, really nice, but they're also extremely durable, which I was kind of shocked at on some of my work boots. You know, Double Shot's the progression from Domani, and it's just filling it in more, giving it a little more oomph, a little more retan, a little more stuffing, or a lot more stuffing, really. And it's been a pretty nice leather to run.
Another one that I believe was developed for Knicks and for footwear, but the 1964. Where's that at? What's it like? Why do you dig it for boots?
You know, it's a good mix between our standard oil tans, which we've been making for forever. Really, when Knicks wanted to get their own custom leather, they really just wanted to kind of incorporate a pull-up leather into the oil tans. I mean, the retan is actually very similar. We do add a little more like wax in the drum versus the oil tans, where we really don't do that. It's a little more wax heavy in finishing. You know, we're rolling on some wax coats. Versus oil tans, where you're really just doing oil. It's kind of like a hybrid piece. Usually there's a differentiation between, you know, a standard oil tan and a wet stuffed piece of leather. And the 1964 kind of in between the two. You get really nice pull up and it's completely aniline. So there's literally nothing on the surface but oil and wax, which is pretty nice.
Yeah, it works, man. It's beautiful stuff. I don't know if you would even know the answer to this, but you know, as I understand it, you know, Knicks was founded in 1964, and, you know, they have a bunch of old boots sitting around, and they're like, can you make us something that looks like this? And it does. It seems like this, you know, kind of interesting vintage leather. Like, if once you wear it, that's kind of the way that it ages. It looks like even older boots than your boots are old. I mean, do you have any idea from like a tanning perspective and, you know, all the other processes, are there similarities to how something might have been made back in the 60s? Or is it just, you know, kind of coming around from the other direction, creating something that lands to, you know, kind of appear and perform similarly?
You know, a lot of the chemicals have changed versus the 60s versus today. I think really the similarity is the amount of vegetable extract that's in that tannage. Back in the day, they used to use vegetable extract as a cheaper way to substitute dye. You know, they would put in mimosa extract as a way to turn the leather brown. In doing that, you know, it gave the leather a nice, richer, you know, rich feel. It also gave it a really high veg content that really helps it patina nicely. And that's really kind of the similarity with, you know, that tannage. I would say most of our oil tans in general also just have a higher veg content than what you would mostly see in the leather industry today. I mean, that's really the thing that would be most closely, you know, resembling that actual leather from the 1960s is the vegetable content in the leather.
Arguably the best name in the business on this one. When there's some good ones out there too, especially when you're going up against a rowdy dachshund. Old Town Folklore. What's the deal with this one?
Old Town Folklore was actually a leather that was developed by Prime Tanning from Berwick, Maine back in the 80s. And we actually have a couple employees that came from Prime. It's long gone now. You know, that leather was essentially a crazy horse with shattery pull-up. And so when we went to redevelop that, we were like, well, you know, that leather is known. We don't really want to call it our own thing. So, you know, you stick with the name that's known. But Old Town Folklore is traditionally, before Prime Tanning went out of business, similar to the crazy horses that were running, just with a more shattery pull-up.
All right. On these Russell moccasins that we did a collaboration on, just shipped them somewhere recently when we're taping, they're using this pebble ski bullhide, which is just fabulous, man. It is wet and it feels very intimidating at first. And like, I kind of caution people on sizing. It's like, don't size not big, like probably. But then I started wearing them because I thought I had missized, and very few leathers that I have worn kind of want to become your foot as much as this really thick, meaty bullhide.
How did it feel on your feet? Because I mean, they put like two pieces of that leather together, right? So, I mean, that's an 8 to 9 ounce leather. I'm guessing you had 16 ounces of leather on your feet.
Yeah. I mean, so it's on these Oxfords. I'm actually wearing them right now. And there's, yeah, kind of three layers in addition to like the plug over the toe. So you've got one, and then wrapping directly underneath that and doubling up is the molded sole, which, you know, is sometimes perhaps incorrectly called the double vamp. Like, technically the double vamp's on the inside. There's a lot of it, especially like lower on the shoe, which there's a lot of contact points there, like for your foot, right? Luke describes it as like a heel counter for your whole foot. And to an extent, it is that, although the leather's obviously different and not quite as stiff. But yeah, man, it's been shocking. It's been like kind of a revelation in terms of, let's say, just how kind the leather is to your foot. I don't know. Like, it wants to like, yeah, become one with it. It's great. Like, how is this happening on this? I mean, the shoes weigh like 4 pounds a piece.
Yeah, it's an interesting leather because it's 8 to 9 ounces, but we have to put a lot of nourishment in the drum to get it malleable because it needs to take a print. That pebbled print in it is actually, we have to slam it in with a hydraulic press. So you need to have give in the leather. And I don't really know the exact intricacies of that tannage. But, you know, it's got a lot of, you know, stuffing in it just so that when you do the dwell time in the hydraulic press that it stays and it kind of molds into the print. That leather was actually developed for snake boots back in the day. So it was meant to be able to stop a rattlesnake bite, which they've got nice big fangs, but it's a thick piece of leather and Yeah, it just has a lot of nourishment in it. A lot of the tannages can feel them between the drying processes. And that is one that always just has, you know, before you dry it, you pull it out of the drum, it's super waxy. Then you paste it. And once it goes through paste wash and final stick dry, it still comes out and you can just feel how saturated it is.
I was startled at just 2 hours into walking around in these things. I was like, wow, this one really worked.
It probably helps too that you have, you know, I think the Russell moccasins are a little closer to, because they only have one piece of veg tan underneath that probably gives you a little more movability, I guess, if that's a word.
That's a word. We should try and spell it now. But yeah, I think on maybe on a boot and maybe on a, you know, a welted boot or, you know, something with like a really firm insole and ire, like they might be more troublesome. Like it's turned out to be a fabulous shoe leather. But I don't know, man. I don't think so. It's one of the most surprising leather. I mean, it looks beautiful. It's just got this great feel to it. And you have the sense that over time it's going to look really darn good. It's not like a quick change, like shapeshifter, you know, like stunt leather either in that way. Like you got to earn it with these things. Another one that I have right here is this leather that Limmer up in New Hampshire has been using.
So that one is actually, it's really close to all of our oil tans because it's actually is one of our logger boot oil tans. Really just at the end, we put a pebble print into it just to give it, you know, a little bit of grain texture, but it's a really nice leather. You know, it's just the same as all of our oil tans. When we're going for those, it's super aniline, tight break. It's just meant to be extremely durable. I think they come out beautiful and they do a really good job of it at Limmer just because it's one solid piece in the upper. When we went to develop it, Adam was telling us like, yeah, I'd like some water resistance. And we were looking at it like, oh, we need to make them like a waterproof. And then, you know, we sampled him a couple different things, but he was just like, no, like I just need an oil tan. And that's when we sent him, you know, our standard black lager oil tan with a pebble print. And he was like, it's perfect.
That's it.
Yeah. It'll age nice. And it's pretty bulletproof. I think it'll last pretty long.
Oh yeah. It's working. It's definitely working.
How long have you been wearing them? You just got yours, right?
I got them last October. Adam came and delivered them to me at our bootcamp event, completely unexpected to me. Put them on and walked around a little bit. And I was like, I might switch back to the other shoes I was wearing for, you know, the rest of this event today. Yeah. I mean, I've given them like a ride since then, like over the winter. Anytime I'm up in the woods, I'm wearing these things and they figure I was lucky enough to fit into just kind of one of the stock lasts that Adam used to make them in the shop. It's fabulous. Any of this is what is your use? What is an aesthetic to an extent, but for Limmer, that's almost certainly not the first thought that they have. Like it's such a function driven boot for me as somebody who is using them loosely as intended. Like I haven't done any 14ers in them, but also cares about this from other perspectives. The break is really nice. Like there's some of these things that probably weren't the first concern for them that just happened to work out on it. Or maybe they fit perfectly. Like who knows, but it's good. And they just beat up nice. And like, I don't really wear black boots, but I love wearing these black boots.
The one thing I always go back to is Adam told me that the original design was a ski boot. Like you really feel it in the ankle support that you get when you're wearing them, but it's not punishing like a ski boot is. It's, you know, once you start wearing them, you're like, oh, you know, it might feel a little different than a Thorogood or something like that. But I think once you get them a little broken in, they're very comfortable.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, they kind of have to be, right? If you're going to be walking in them.
Go do the Appalachian Trail and
all. Yeah, but again, it's also like there's durability built into it and, you know, all these things, right? Like nobody makes boots like these. They're just as indestructible as anything gets and so focused on support for specific activities. Yeah, I mean, the leather itself is working with, for them, like this age-old design.
It's kind of crazy that, you know, you look at where hiking boots have gone in the last 30, 40 years, where a lot of people tend towards like the really light and more man-made materials in them, which I'm sure people love. But when you find people that are wearing Limmers or you hear like the reviews about them, it's kind of crazy that everybody swears by them. It's about as old of a construction or like as traditional of a construction as you can get.
Yeah, man. They're built different. Thank you for contributing to them.
Yeah. They are built different. Yeah.
All right. One more. So any tannery that's kind of worth its stuff will make a latigo leather. I have like a loose understanding of what they are, but if you could tell us a little bit about that. And, you know, you don't often see leather kind of names, or I guess in this case, types, permeate throughout all these different tanneries, right? Everybody's calling things Old Town Folklore instead of latigo. So like, what is a latigo, and what's up with the latigo that you guys are making? And am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yeah, latigo, or that's at least what we call it. Really, what it is traditionally is a really heavily stuffed piece of leather, really nourished. And it's originally for saddles. You know, when we do make a lot of latigo, it's primarily like black, brown, and burgundy. And they're just really heavily stuffed. You know, what they say is when you take a cutting of it, they say it's supposed to cut like cheese. And when you whittle it, you know, it just does nice, long, like twirly spindles come off of it, essentially. Latigo has now become more of a just common term where everybody goes, oh, yeah, it's our latigo. And really what it kind of means is just a heavier weight tannage. Most stuff is pretty dry and just overfinished now. You know, where we go with it is we still try to do as, you know, stuffed as possible, especially this time of year. It's, you know, it's March. It can be kind of tough to make them because, you know, the hides come a little more drawn out. It's not the best time of year to make belt leathers.
Because of the actual, the animals and what's happening with them.
Yeah, we see a lot, like in the winter, you see a lot more like quality issues just because of, you know, the animals sitting in feedlots. You know, if it's snowy and wet, sometimes you'll see like what we call diaper rash. Which is, it's like what babies get, but cows will get it on their bellies. So it can create some quality issues. As far as like latigos, you know, the ones that we make are very aniline. Basically, latigo at the end of the day is a very nourished piece of leather. If somebody's trying to sell you latigo, you know, ask them, can you whittle it? You know, how's the feel? And is it natural?
I can't wait to make somebody whittle some latigo for me.
Yeah, be like, get out a knife and give me a nice long strip and see if it cuts like cheese.
Yeah, it's like, that's not cheese-ish at all. What the hell? What about something for footwear, for boots, shoes, whatever, that you guys are making that maybe is underutilized? I mean, it could be one of these, but you know, a lot of these are kind of boot leathers that I'm familiar with. Like, is there something that you have made, are making for something else that you think could be applicable, that I should make some boots with somebody with, somebody should make some boots with?
Aged bark used to be a really nice, it's a crazy horse tannage that it's a really nice, like bright amber color.
Yeah, my first pair of Ibergs were the old aged bark rough outs.
That used to be a great leather. You know, a lot of those programs have transitioned to like Mexico or the DR at this point. But, you know, if anybody wants some aged bark, you know, we make a really nice aged bark. So go pester your footwear companies.
All right, good.
That would be the one that I would say.
That was a meaningful one for me. Viberg Scout Boots. Got them at the sample sale. Agebark Rough Outs admitted like 2.5 years later that they were the wrong size. But man, I wore the hell out of these things.
Too small or too big?
Too small. Every time I got in them, I'm like, man, I think these are the wrong size. And then you'd wear them. I was living in New York at the time, so I was walking a ton. And, you know, you'd get 10 blocks and you'd be like, all right, yeah, they're fine enough. The next time you put them on again, you're like, I think these are the wrong size. Incredible pair of boots, though. I miss them. All right. Well, I mean, that's a pretty good rundown on leathers. And we've lost your dad. So, I mean, look, this, you know, through, you know, issues, technical and otherwise, this podcast episode has been about 79 years in the making. And you now, as the fourth generation guy, like the torch is in your hand. What's Seidel and American Tanning going to look like in another 79 years when we tape another episode? Or, you know, like, next decade or two? A lot has changed since certainly the 50s, and the 90s seem to be another shift. It's almost in kind of like 30-year cycles. Like, can you see it at all?
At least in my time working in the tannery, I think I'm coming up on 10 years at this point. I've seen a lot of change in the tannery. You know, it seems like every year the leather industry in the U.S., in my opinion, seems to be growing a little bit. And so I hope, you know, in 79 years, we're still doing the same thing, making what I would say is superior leathers. Hopefully we'll have moved into a newer building at that point. But, you know, where I'd like to see, you know, this business go is I think we can continue making what I would say is superior leathers to what you see in a lot of other parts of the world. I think people are starting to understand a little bit more that, you know, it's not just about bottom of the barrel pricing. Where stuff is made and how it's made is important. I think you guys really help with something like that. I think your listeners and your readers are a little more in tuned than the average consumer. But I think with the internet and a lot of social media, I think a lot more people care about where their products are being made. So I think that's a huge boost for us. People can come here and see, you know, what we do. It's not like you have to fly across the world. It's, we're doing it right here. So, you know, my hope is we just continue making the great leathers and people keep wanting them.
You know, you're not allowed to do anything else, right?
Yeah, no, I'm pretty locked in at this point. So,
all right, good.
Yeah, not going anywhere. Don't worry.
All right, man. With that news, let's call it. Huge thanks to Seidel Lovers Nix Boots for sponsoring the episode. Don't forget to save the date for our boot camp event this October 12th and 13th, 2024, in Industry City, Brooklyn, a celebration of the best worldwide shoemaking and the amazing community that loves it. Plenty of leather. We're going to have hands-on courses, make things with leather. You can probably make a pair of shoes if you want to devote the time. Museum exhibits, like just getting people to learn about all of this and, you know, help spread the word to them. And hopefully they can kind of tap their friend on the shoulder and, you know, exactly what Chris just said. Just think about what you own, where it was made, how it was made, and the importance of it and the beauty that can come from it. Tickets on sale soon, and get to know that absolutely wonderful community that you'll see at Bootcamp in our private Discord while lending your hugely appreciated support to this very podcast with a Stitchdown premium membership. More info on stitchdown.com. But most of all, Fritz, thanks to you and your father, despite his current absence, for coming on, man. This was great. Deeply informational and about as nerdy as things can get, which I appreciate.
Oh, yeah. No, thank you. I really appreciate coming on and had a great time.
All right, good. That's it for this week. Take care of your shoes. We'll see you next time.